I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of reporters in Washington, and they cover everything from the White House to Congress to the Pentagon to, well, you get the idea. There's a ton of news happening here. Today, some of those reporters, some with connections to Missouri, explain how they do it. Whether it's for a newspaper or an online publication, we'll ask how they decide what to cover in a city where news breaks hourly. Then NPR Shankar Vedantam, who examines the news through the lens of human behavior and the social sciences, will ask the host of Hidden Brain what inspired his novel approach to explaining the everyday and the extraordinary. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Spend any time at all in Washington these days, as we are this week, and you get the feeling that history is being written as a president of the United States again faces impeachment proceedings. This morning, we're going to meet with three reporters who are now covering national politics here in the country's capital city. Two of them have Missouri connections. We're going to ask them about where the country is headed as impeachment hangs over the Oval Office as they report for print, digital, and broadcast media. With us, Eli Yokley reports for Morning Consult. He went to the University of Missouri and is from Webb City, Missouri, just outside of Joplin. Eli, it's great to have you again. Welcome.
Good to see you, man.
Brian Lowry is the Washington correspondent for the Kansas City Star. Before that, he covered the Kansas State House for the Wichita Eagle. Brian, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Good to see you.
Matt Laszlo is also here. He's with Vice News, and he's on the board at the Regional Reporters Association, where he represents regional reporters based in Washington. Matt, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, Brian, what's the atmosphere like out here this week with impeachment hanging in the air once again?
It's been interesting. It's pretty intense over on the Hill, and lawmakers from the Kansas City area have really been navigating this in a lot of interesting ways. One really interesting contrast is Roy Blunt versus Josh Hawley. So yesterday, saw Roy Blunt come off the Senate subway. He puts his hand on my shoulder and he says, "I'm not going to have a lot to say until I gather some more information. You know, I've read everything, but the Senate Intelligence Committee, we're going to have access to talk to the people, so I'll have more to say at that time." Very, very kind of calm and careful statement from Senator Blunt. Josh Hawley is calling it, he's blasting the whistleblower complaint as double and triple hearsay. He was holding court about how dare the House pursue this. Very aggressive response. And so from those two Republicans from the same state, you see how some Republicans are ready to respond and really defend Trump, and others actually do want to take a slightly more cautious approach. I know Matt actually had an interesting interaction with Jerry Moran of Kansas, who still has not said anything so far this week about either the impeachment inquiry or the Ukraine allegations.
Matt, tell us about that. You've been out here for more than a dozen years. What have you noticed?
It's been interesting. I think to a degree you could say Nancy Pelosi tipped her hand a little too soon. If she would have just waited 24 hours until you actually had the transcript, she would have had some evidence she could point to. So She kind of fed into these GOP talking points that we're seeing. But you can say that she was answering the will of her party, and her party really did turn on a dime. We saw the wind fall. What? 60 members turned in a day.
Senator Moran isn't commenting right now?
No, Moran's not. I had one Republican. I overheard a Republican talking on background yesterday. And on background, he said, "This is inappropriate." These guys are running scared of Trump.
Yeah, Eli.
I mean, it's interesting what you say about Nancy Pelosi, that she responded to her party here. I mean, if you look at the polling on this, her party responded to her. I mean, at Morning Consult, we did this in the days after she announced her support for impeachment. And we saw a 13-point net swing among American in favor of impeachment from just this weekend. And so as we see this roll out, I mean, the Democrats are really leading the message. The American people are listening. And this is such an easy thing to understand. Mm-hmm. To Brian's point, I mean, this shows sort of a divide in the Republican Party as it is today. You've got the Roy Blunt, classic Republican, who sort of take an even-keeled approach, and you have the Josh Hawley, Trumpian folks here today who are really carrying the firebrand for Trump.
But as we sit here this morning, Eli, is there a single Republican from Kansas or Missouri or really anywhere across the country who's out saying we need to go ahead and investigate and possibly impeach?
I mean, Mitt Romney has raised some concerns about this in recent days. Justin Amash, a former Republican, now an independent, is on board with impeachment. But among the party overall, you've got a lot of people standing by Donald Trump, with the exception of two governors. You've got the governor of Massachusetts and the governor of Vermont saying they're open to an inquiry. So you are seeing some movement. It turns out that those are some of the most popular governors in the country today in these blue states that they represent.
But Brian, no one from Kansas or Missouri.
No. But the Democrats from the region actually have had some interesting responses. Emmanuel Cleaver has supported for a little while an inquiry. He officially came out beyond that for impeachment, for articles of impeachment to be drafted. The congressman, you know, came to that this week. He showed me a text message he got from his daughter yesterday, which said, "Hooray, you finally listened." Mm. Cleaver's been hearing it from constituents. He's been hearing it from his own family members for quite some time. And he says he's just getting a lot of thank yous for finally coming out. And what he told me was these Ukraine allegations are just much easier to explain to people than some of the other things that people have looked at with the president. Sharice Davids from Kansas, the freshman Dem, has taken a bit more of a careful approach. Mm-hmm. She is officially in favor of the impeachment inquiry. She hasn't gone that extra step yet.
But waited until just the other day.
And even the way in which she did it, first she releases, you know, the day that Pelosi announces the impeachment inquiry, Congresswoman Davids released a statement saying she supports the House investigations continuing unimpeded. And that's essentially supporting the impeachment inquiry, but she didn't use the word impeachment until the next day after the White House memo detailing the call came out, and then she was comfortable using that word impeachment, and she's even actually fundraising off it too. She put a fundraising email out yesterday.
She'll need it.
Yeah. So Matt, what do you expect here then in the weeks ahead? We're still in some ways in the same place we were a few days ago. You might begin to expect an investigation and possibly a vote in the House on impeachment, but the Senate being held by Republicans, we're not seeing any change in the math or the temperature there, are we? Or
no, and just a quick reminder for listeners, the Senate will stand trial. If the House passes these articles of impeachment, it looks like they have the 218 votes to get that through, then the Senate will stand trial, and they'll have to, even though it's Mitch McConnell's Senate, and he obviously opposes this and is in lockstep with basically anything Trump does. But it's interesting, getting the pulse of all these Republican senators, from Hawley to Moran, they're very unified. And I haven't seen Washington in my 13 years here. I haven't seen it this hyperpartisan. It seems, I even asked Senator Kramer from North Dakota the other day, I said, if the president shot a man on Fifth Avenue, would that be impeachable? He said, well, then the president should go to jail and lose his gun rights. But the question was getting at something deeper. Is there anything Trump can do that would make him impeachable in Republican minds? And I honestly don't think there is.
Well, in the meantime, Republicans are explaining this how, Matt. What are they saying about what the president did?
It's Joe Biden. Investigate Biden. They really are. The conservative messaging machine is so powerful and so aggressive these days. They're really trying to flip it on Biden himself.
So it's literally the presidential campaign of 2020 has come home to roost in this impeachment proceeding.
Yeah.
One more response is to sort of deflect in the way of complaining about how this is going to get in the way of everything else. Pat Roberts, who did vote to remove Bill Clinton from office the last time we went through impeachment proceedings, he commented, well, we went through all that last time and then every Democrat voted no, every Republican voted yes. He lamented that this is going to get in the way of trade deals, other things. He's retiring from the Senate, and he said, I just had more things I wanted to pass. Mm-hmm. Roger Marshall from Kansas, that's also his talking point. Well, this is going to get in the way of the USMCA and all these other things that we need to get done. So for Republicans who don't want to grapple as much with the allegations of Trump, one argument is just to talk about how this has taken the oxygen out of the room and put everything else to a grinding halt.
Were any of those things moving anyway?
Yeah. Not necessarily. No, yeah.
I was going to say.
It's
sorry to be that guy.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're coming to you live from NPR headquarters in Washington this morning. visiting with three very good reporters about their work here in Washington. Eli Yokley from Morning Consult, Brian Lowry from the Kansas City Star, Matt Laszlo was with Vice News. Eli, maybe it's obvious. I just was curious to ask you about your own decision to leave the friendly confines of Jeff City and Missouri and come out here to the wasp nest here of Washington, D.C. Why did you want to make this jump?
I think it made sense at the time. I mean, this is a great place to be as a young journalist. Mm-hmm. And the last 3 years, 3 or 4 years kind of proved that to me. This time in Washington during the Trump era has just been fascinating. You've seen votes on healthcare, repealing Obamacare. You've seen a presidential election that was unpredictable. You've seen a change in the structure of the House leadership. And now we're seeing impeachment. I mean, where else would you want to be as a young reporter in the country right now?
The difference between reporting in Jeff City and reporting in Washington in a word or a sentence, what is it, Eli?
Accessibility. Folks are a lot more accessible back home, and I miss that a lot.
I was going to say, I bet you do.
I mean, Phil Brooks from St. Louis, he was a reporter in Jeff City for a long time, said that he was out here in Washington for a while as he was a young reporter. And the thing he hated about it the most was how insulated all these politicians are. It's really easy for them to avoid us as reporters.
You can't get to them to get comments on the stories that you're working on, or at least it's very difficult to do that, you're saying.
It's hard. I mean, we talk about the Josh Hawley talked about the hallway roulette, and that's almost how you have to do it. You've got to chase folks around and find them where they are. It's kind of awkward sometimes. It's not as easy as picking up the phone or texting a state representative or somebody who works for the governor.
You get them where? Like where do you catch a U.S. senator to grab a quote for a story?
Sometimes you find them in the hallways. Sometimes you find them at the subway underneath the Capitol that connects the buildings together. Sometimes you find them at events around town. I mean, that's sometimes one of the easier places to do it because they've got to walk to their car at some point, right? I mean, you kind of feel like a glorified stalker in some of these jobs mm-hmm. sometimes, knowing where these people are going to be, when they're going to be there, and hoping that maybe they'll talk to you for a minute.
One of my secrets is outside the House floor, there's the ladies' room and then the men's room. So, you know, the older men with bladder problems, you know where they're going to be going.
I have staked out the bathroom before.
Yeah. I hate doing it for female lawmakers, but it's part of our job.
Well, Brian Lowry, congratulations. You're a glorified stalker, I understand, based on what your colleagues are saying.
Well, and I am the one who Josh Hawley, early in his tenure, told that he wouldn't play hallway roulette, although he's gotten much more comfortable with hallway roulette. Yep. I mean, you can see him now holding court, but early on he was very standoffish towards the press, particularly the local press.
You know, Brian, what interests you about this city in particular? I mean, is it the history? Is it the energy? The fact you can walk down the street and bump into a member of Congress? Is it the White House just not far away? What grabs you about
Washington? I think one thing, just having cut my teeth first in Topeka and then in Kansas City, that's interesting is how many people I covered back in Topeka who are now here. Or you know, I covered when I was at the Wichita Eagle. The congressman I used to talk to every now and then when I was a Wichita Eagle reporter is now the Secretary of State.
Right.
The governor that I used to have so much fun chasing around the Kansas Capitol is now the ambassador in charge of ensuring global religious freedom.
Sam Brownback. Yeah.
And so it's interesting to and the Attorney General we used to cover in Missouri is now here as a U.S. Senator. So it's interesting to. I guess in some way I kind of followed those other people out here. So, yeah, maybe it is glorified stalking.
What grabs you about being here, Matt? You've been here for 13 years, yeah. I think. Yeah.
I'm a nerd. One of my side projects is to read a biography on every U.S. president. So I've really enjoyed it, and I did my master's on the increase in partisanship from the 70s on. So I'm a junkie for this stuff. In part, I feel like a failure because these people keep getting more hyper-partisan, even though I keep telling them to chill out and be statesmen and stateswomen because that's what the Constitution gave us. But I digress because they're fundraising.
What about the
history
of Washington, D.C.? Are there places you've been that sort of gave you chills as you walked around?
One of my favorite things, so I've been working in the Capitol for 13 years now, but every once in a while you're there very late at night for a vote, and sometimes I'll be the only person in the rotunda, and every time I just stop and take it in. It's just a glorious, glorious building. Used to be the world's greatest deliberative body. I don't know if we can say that anymore, but there's
the
a lot of history.
Still nice.
What's that?
The architecture's still nice.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Politicians can't ruin that.
Eli, how about you?
I mean, it is kind of amazing they give us keys to that place. Yeah. They kind of let us run free around there. I was there a few weeks ago on a Friday night. One of my friends has one of the offices on the back with a balcony, and we had a couple drinks out there. And it was probably 9 o'clock. We were walking around the Capitol by ourselves. It was kind of amazing just to see this grand building that is just usually full of tourists running around, or usually full of lawmakers, almost empty. I mean, there were a few cops or something, but other than that, I mean, we had the whole place to ourselves. And it's one of those moments where you check yourself that we sort of work in a museum, and it's cool, and sometimes it's crazy, and sometimes the people are crazy, and sometimes the tourists don't know where they are. But we have a grand opportunity for all of ourselves that we get to work here every day.
Next time I want an invite to that balance.
Yeah, no kidding. What was the biggest adjustment you had to make coming out here to the East Coast, Brian?
Well, you know, I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in Philadelphia, only a 90-minute train ride up there. But I will say, just from a reporting context, echo what Eli said earlier, when you're in Topeka or you're in Jeff City, you just wander into a lawmaker's office. You sit down. They'll talk with you. They tend to not have a large professional staff. Maybe they have a secretary. Maybe something else. But they're just much more accessible as human beings. Whereas the amount of intermediaries that you have to deal with in covering lawmakers who really want to make sure that they don't actually say anything or get in trouble. Also, the level of competition is interesting, because one thing that I think that it makes it, in a way, difficult to get those really honest and interesting comments from lawmakers is anytime you talk to a lawmaker, you're swarmed by other reporters, because it is so competitive. And I mean, one of the big stories I broke while I was out here was that the USDA was moving 500 jobs out to Kansas City,
right,
and that had been selected over these other sites. One way I got that was by haranguing every member of the Kansas and Missouri delegation every time I saw them, as I knew that the process was going on, and getting those updates from Pat Roberts and Roy Blunt and others. And I remember there would be other reporters who wanted to talk about the news of the day, and I'm asking Pat Roberts about the USDA. They get mad and they flash a look. Why are you asking him about that? And it's like, well, because these things matter to people back home. Like, this is going to be a big thing for people back home when that happens.
Eli, explain it to me. Why are there so many layers between you walking into the door of a member of Congress and getting to that representative? Is it just what Brian said, which is they don't want to be caught saying something stupid? Is that what our Congress sort of is all about?
Yeah. I mean, these guys are surrounded by a lot of staff. They want to get reelected. I mean, like Matt said, I mean, it's hyper-partisanship here in D.C. to a T. I mean, I remember how I always thought Josh Hawley, for example, was pretty accessible on the ground in Missouri. Gets to Washington, and it's a lot harder to nail him down if you're not a Fox News anchor at night.
Yeah.
I think a lot of these folks want to have their moment. They want to save it to get on TV or to make something that maybe the president will see for them. And it sort of gets in the way. I think Brian does have an advantage, he's described it as a challenge, but working for a regional newspaper, something that is falling in D.C. to some of their lowest levels in history, at least the member thinks that they might need to talk to you.
Right. I will say I have had funny interactions with Pat Roberts. In particular, is the member of our delegation who is most respectful of, this is the person who I want to talk to. Where if I'll see him talking to another crowd of reporters, I'll come up, he'll like stop. He's like, what do you need? And so there are members who do realize that this is the person I need to talk to. There's also the members who fear that, though, too, because they know that their constituents actually read you.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a little contrarian here. My intern this spring was from Holland, and she was a master's student, and she was like, wow, you guys have such an accessible capital, able to do all these interviews. So a lot of it, it's a huge building, so lawmakers can hide from us when they want to. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's very accessible, and we have a lot of access to them. Sometimes, though, when you do the formal call their office, you know, I tried to get Amy Klobuchar to talk about her Honest Ads Act on Russian interference in the election. They still haven't gotten back to me over a week. But I might run into her in the Capitol on my way back today. So it just depends.
Yeah. The lawmakers are always better at dealing with reporters than their staffs oftentimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm talking with three reporters who have regional connections, regional reporting credentials here in the nation's capital as we come to you live. You know, Eli, one thing I wondered about, this idea that when you were covering in Jeff City, you were one of a handful of reporters covering the state capitol, the governor's office, the attorney general, and all those folks. Out here, you're one one of hundreds, mm-hmm. if not thousands. I've lost track of how many are out here. How do you wrestle with that idea?
That was a challenge. I mean, you've got to rethink about how you approach some of these things. I mean, one of my things I was most proud of back home was I put 5,000 miles on my car a year, basically, driving around the state, going around, seeing folks where they live. That's not something that's as accessible here. Right. You know, we try to find ways to find an end to a story, kind of where we can stand out. I mean, that's one of the great things about Morning Consult is if we see something happening in the news every week, we can pull it and get it back in 2 days and make an impact on the story. Mm-hmm. Nobody else is walking up to a senator asking a question armed with 2,000 voters behind him, carrying their opinions.
Yeah.
You guys, just real quick, you guys are doing awesome work because, you do the splashy news of the day, but you guys are actually much more serious policy-oriented publication, which has been one of the sad things about watching the Washington Press Corps in the past 15 or whatever years.
Yeah.
Now everyone's chasing these shiny, chic objects as opposed to giving us the policy. Politics is supposed to be boring. It's policy.
How do you wrestle with this idea, Brian?
I mean, one thing we do, we actually try to not devote ourselves to the story of the day.
Right.
And we do occasionally write about it. Certainly, it's worth getting lawmakers to weigh in for their constituents. But where we can really bring value is chasing stories that really matter to people living in Kansas and Missouri that the New York Times and Washington Post aren't necessarily chasing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really been the approach, is to try and find unique angles, things nobody else is covering. And, you know, right now it's
like the USDA moving to Kansas City.
Right. And it's fun. It's fun work. It's sometimes lonely work. Right now, I am the only person covering either the state of Kansas or Missouri exclusively on the Hill, because, you know, the Eagle and the Star, our sister paper, the Wichita Eagle and the Star, were the only people paying attention in the state of Kansas. Missouri, just a few years ago, used to have a lot more coverage. Springfield News Leader and St. Louis Post-Dispatch had correspondents. They don't anymore. So right now, it is kind of a solo operation.
Matt, you were talking about that before the show, this decline in the U.S. Capitol reporting core. You've been here for a while. What have you noticed as the years have passed, as you've seen the shrinkage, if you will, as we're seeing in newspapers all across the country?
So, like we said earlier, I'm on the board at the Regional Reporters Association, and our numbers have been decimated. One of the guys in the organization used to be the bureau chief of Newsday, had a bureau of 22. Now he's the bureau chief of one.
Yeah.
And that's 22 bodies who would be prying and looking into that local delegation.
Yeah.
And now that's just not there, which is why Brian's work is so great.
I mean, we're noticing that decline in Washington, but it's not just in Washington. I mean, this is in state capitals all across the country. Whenever I was back
Absolutely.
In Missouri, I was the first person to cover the Capitol for the Joplin Globe in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big moment. I mean, we had leadership posts across the board, basically. And Carol Stark, the late editor there, made a decision to invest in that. And it worked. I mean, got a lot of readers. People loved it. I think if you're a regional paper right now in Trump's Washington, there are stories here to tell. It's just a matter of whether you want to pay to have somebody here.
Yeah. Before you guys go, Brian, talk to me a little bit about Missouri Senator Josh Hawley. You've mentioned here today. He's made a big deal of really going after the big social media giants on privacy and a whole host of issues. How successful has he been? How much attention is he getting? Is he making a difference on that front?
In terms of attention, he's been very successful. In terms of passing legislation, there hasn't been any legislation passed yet related to these tech companies. Now, there is a big push, whether or not any of Hawley's bills, which tend to be, you know, he has some that are bipartisan, but he also has some which, like, requiring social media companies to undergo audits to check for political mm-hmm. bias. Those bills are very unlikely to move forward. However, what Hawley has done is he's been able to sort of self-appoint himself as the main critic of the tech industry on Capitol Hill. Last week, he met with Mark Zuckerberg, and Zuckerberg was meeting with a host of lawmakers on the Hill. Zuckerberg wasn't saying very much about his meetings. You know, there were at least 40, maybe more reporters, and I was one of them outside Hawley's office. After Zuckerberg leaves, Senator Hawley emerged and he spoke for 15 minutes. So he's at least, well, he has not been successful in passing legislation. He has found a way to make it so that he is the go-to guy for technology reporters to comment on the industry.
One absolutely final point before you go. Lots of talk about U.S. Senator Pat Roberts. He's leaving the Senate after 40 years in Washington. Open seat race here. Is Mike Pompeo, the U.S. Secretary of State, is he going to run for this seat or not? The signals have been all over the
place
for
months.
You've been reporting on this like crazy.
Now,
where are we going
now,
there?
First of all, if I did have the definitive answer for that, that would go on KansasCity.com.
Oh,
first.
Stop it. I would go on KCUR.org.
Yeah. However, I will say he remains the top choice of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Right.
Certainly there is a lot of concern among national Republicans about Kris Kobach's candidacy after his loss in the 2018 governor's race. Congressman Roger Marshall has gotten into the race. What Marshall needs to do over the next couple months is really convince people that he can do it, that they don't need to recruit the Secretary of State into this race. But there is definitely pressure from a large segment of national Republicans to get Pompeo into this race and keep it in GOP hands.
We're going to have to leave it right there. As much as I want to continue talking with my old buddies here, that was the voice of Brian Lowry, the Washington correspondent for the Kansas City Star. Eli Yokley was here. He covers for Morning Consult. We also had Matt Laszlo with Vice News. So good to see you guys. Thanks for taking time. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
After a short break, NPR Shankar Vedantam joins us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske, coming to you live from the nation's capital NPR headquarters this week. You can get a little more Kraske each week in your inbox. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to sign up for my newsletter, Kraske Off Mic. Every Monday, get my exclusive takes on the things we cover on the show, plus highlights from the up-to-date team, but only if you go to kcur.org/Kraske. Monday, privilege and appropriation have turned college campuses into minefields. Hear why liberal discourse is being threatened by a shift in American academia. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, NPR Shankar Vedantam has been thinking a lot about death lately. In recent episodes of his wildly popular Hidden Brain segments, he considered how the specter of death shapes all manner of decisions we make, from the risks we take to the politicians we elect. He's also reported on how people seek to resolve their fears of death. Of course, Shankar's work goes well beyond that not-so-pleasant topic. He's also studied how we derive meaning from our jobs and why reusable shopping bags make us want to buy more junk food. That was one of my favorite ones. All these are questions answered by the study of human behavior, and no one explains the answers to those questions better than Shankar Vedantam. He is NPR social science correspondent and host of The Hidden Brain. Hidden Brain is among the most popular podcasts in the world, with over 2 million, if you can believe it, downloads a week. Shankar, what a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
Well, this is a fascinating idea to me, how the fear of death shapes all manner of decisions we make, from the risks we take to the politicians we elect. Explain that to me.
Well, this really goes back a very long way, Steve, almost 100 years or more. People have realized that human beings have this capacity to realize, perhaps uniquely among all animals, that we are mortal, that we're going to die. Your average goat or sheep doesn't go around
thinking about that.
One day I'm going to die, but your average human being knows one day I am going to die. And so the question is, how do we go through our lives knowing that this terrifying outcome is inevitable? And there's been a lot of research looking at this question, and we did a couple of episodes focusing on this topic, and it is a grim topic, but it has some really amusing implications in some ways.
Well,
we come up with a whole series of mental defenses to guard ourselves, to keep in some ways from feeling the terror of death. This is sometimes called terror management theory. And there's all kinds of interesting implications of how human behavior changes because of the fear of death.
What's an example of one of those things?
Well, at a very simple level, one of the things we seek to do when we are confronted with the fear of death is we try and embed ourselves more strongly in things that might be more more immortal than us. So, for example, I'm more likely to identify with my sports team or my religion or my country or my nation or my group in when I'm confronted with the fear of death, because it tells me I might die, but there's a part of me that's going to live on in the values and in the people who are part of my larger group. So one of the consequences of being confronted with the fear of death is often people retreat into cultural safe havens. They feel
really
safer within the confines of their group.
How did you get started thinking about this idea of death?
Well, what we do on Hidden Brain is we explore a number of different topics. I'm not sure this was specifically driven by any specific thought that I had about death. Terror management theory is one of the most interesting theories in psychology, and there's a vast literature looking at a whole bunch of research studies looking at what happens when people are confronted with the fear of death. One of the other things that happens, for example, is that people become more generous when they're confronted with the fear of death because they want to leave a legacy behind. They want to seem like they're kind and generous people. There have been amusing experiments that have been conducted where you ask people to make a charitable donation, except some people are asked in front of a funeral home and other people are asked the very same question 100 yards down the road. And people who are asked the question in front of the funeral home turn out to be more generous when asked the identical question than people who are far away from the funeral home.
That might be useful for member stations to think about.
Indeed.
During fund drive
time. Indeed. So, you know,
time.
At pledge drive time, make sure that you're packaging it with stories about death.
Well, where do your ideas for Hidden Brain come from? Are readers sending you ideas? I imagine you're constantly culling through the literature and the research to keep up with things. Where are you going?
So that's exactly right. So we read very widely in the academic literature to try and see what's happening, look at new research papers.
How big is your team?
We have a team of about six people. I sort of read about between 150 and 200 academic journals on a fairly regular basis. And so I'm reading very voluminously. Listeners send in ideas and stories all the time, and some of our best story ideas in some ways have come from listeners. But there's a third source, which in some ways is all around us, which is daily life gives you story ideas. And when you're covering human behavior, your beat is really all around you all the time.
Do you have a notepad in your pocket? Are you constantly taking notes as you're out to lunch thinking, this might be a good idea?
It's more, I think, when you're having conversations with people and you sort of say, that's really interesting because the same theme has come up in five other conversations. So I'll give you one example. A lot of people I talk with today tell me they're exhausted with the news from politics. They're just exhausted by what's happening.
I'm raising my hand. You can't see in the radio. I used to cover politics for most of my career,
right.
And I really am.
And you can see this certainly in the journalists in the newsroom. People who are covering this are just, you know, they walk around as if they're exhausted. But this is also true for listeners, that there's a feeling I'm just overwhelmed. I'm interested. I want to stay connected to the news, but it's just too much.
Yes.
And when you hear this over and over again, it actually leads to the question, why is this happening? What does this mean? What does it mean that people who are actually engaged with the news feel like they want to switch off because they can't take it anymore? What does that mean for questions of democracy? And I think we're exploring a topic in one of our upcoming episodes that looks at what happens when you have this kind of news fatigue.
Is the answer any more complicated than the certain approach to the office that President Trump has taken?
Well, I think in some ways part of the problem is that we have a system which is not very good anymore at calibrating what we should be concerned about. And so what happens is if you turn on your Twitter or you turn on your television or sometimes even when you turn on the radio, people are telling you constantly, you need to be worried about this issue because this issue is the single most important issue confronting you.
Yes.
The problem is you hear that on Monday and then you hear about a different issue on Tuesday and then you hear a different issue on Wednesday and something else on Thursday. And by Friday, you're saying, how can the volume be turned to 11 on everything?
Yes.
And your response to that psychologically, very understandably, is to say, I'm just going to turn the volume off.
You know, it's so interesting you say that. When I talk to my dad, who's in his 90s now up in Minnesota, talk to him several times a week, he invariably says to me, I go, Dad, how you doing? And he says, well, I'm worried about this climate change thing, or I'm worried about the kid who's been missing in Texas. And he really absorbs the news, follows it very closely. I can tell it's really affecting him after more than 90 years on the planet Earth.
Yeah, and when you think about how our minds were designed to work, Steve, our minds were constructed to pay pay attention to threats that were in our immediate vicinity, right? So through much of our evolutionary history, what are the things that you were concerned about? You were concerned about whether you had enough food to eat, whether you had water, whether you had mates, whether you had you could survive a predator. But now what's happened with technology is that we're aware of problems that are happening in very distant places very far away from us. Mm-hmm. And science is telling us about problems that confront us that might not be here today, but might be here 10 years yes. from now or 20 years from now. And so all of a sudden, our minds, which in some ways are designed to deal with a narrow suite of problems, are trying to confront these vast problems,
yes.
many of which we have no control or ability to influence.
NPR Shankar Vedantam is my guest. In another recent story you did, you wrestled with another very interesting common issue: to what extent people find meaning in the work they do. You found that it depends on whether people feel, I thought this is so interesting, whether they have a job, a career, or a calling. Tell us about that.
Well, this is research from Amy Rosnowski at Yale University. She spent a lot of time looking at different workers and different institutions. And you can actually see this when you go to work every day, that there are people who come into work and it's clear that they don't actually want to be there. And they're there because they need to be there. They're earning a paycheck
yes.
and they're supporting their families.
Yes.
But the work itself is not a source of joy. The work itself is not a source of energy or enthusiasm. And there are other people who are also coming in for a paycheck, but they also feel and experience their work as a calling. They experience their work as something that's not just instrumental, but the work in itself has meaning and value.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Amy Rosnowski did is, for example, she interviewed workers at a hospital. And she found that some hospital workers, you know, they and these were people who were not necessarily the doctors or the administrators, not necessarily the people at the top of the pecking order, but people who were janitors and people who were helping keep patient wards clean. And she found that some of them basically were doing this as a job, and just as a job, and others thought of themselves as basically saying, I am here because people are coming to the hospital in pain and in suffering,
sure.
and what I can do can help them actually recover better.
Hmm.
So the person who was now cleaning your room doesn't just say, let me just clean your room. They're actually saying, I'm going to clean the ceiling of your room, because if you're a patient lying in a hospital bed, you're actually spending a lot of time looking at the ceiling of your room, and
mm-hmm.
it's my job to make sure that your experience in this hospital bed is as good as it can be so that you can recover.
I'm contributing to your well-being in a sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so in other words, they didn't define themselves as janitors or as cleaners. They defined themselves as healers. And one of the things that Amy Rosnowski finds is that these people, obviously, they do a much better job at the job they're doing, but they also experience a whole host of psychological benefits. They're much less likely to burn out. They're much less likely to suffer sort of the deleterious effects of interpersonal conflict at work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, understand, it's, in some ways, it's intuitively obvious. You are motivated, you enjoy what you're doing, and that enthusiasm in some ways buffers you from the, you know, the effects of all the hard things about work.
Hey, how did you get started with your focus on human behavior and the social sciences? Because I know you did some of this work when you were with newspapers. How did you get going here?
I was a print reporter for many years, first at the Philadelphia Inquirer and then
yeah.
at the Washington Post.
Yeah, boy.
and you know what that's like.
Yes,
the
I
world
do.
Of print journalism is not fun. But I became a science journalist very early in my career and then slowly gravitated to covering the brain, partly because it felt to me that the biggest questions that were unanswered about in science were really questions about how the mind works. I mean, really basic questions, you know, why
we
do
don't know a lot of
we
that
We don't
yet.
Know a lot. You know,
yeah.
how does a thought form? Why do we sleep?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we interact with others? The psychology of our behaviors is so fascinating. And I slowly got more and more involved in this. And when I thought about this, I realized this is a subject that actually affects everything else. Human behavior touches on politics. It touches on science. It touches on sports. It touches on relationships. It touches on our hobbies. It touches on everything in our lives. And so in some ways, covering human behavior was a trick that I came up with, really, to basically pursue any story that I found interesting.
So you call the podcast Hidden Brain. Why?
So Hidden Brain was the title of a book that I wrote in 2010, The Hidden
mm-hmm.
Brain. And in
mm-hmm.
some ways, it's a term that I coined to describe what researchers were discovering about how, without our conscious awareness, a large amount of what our minds do is actually hidden from us. So at
yeah.
a very basic level, you know, you're sitting in front of me right now, you're paying attention to the conversation, but you weren't actually paying attention to the fact that your brain was actually telling your stomach muscles to keep your body body sitting up in the chair. It was mm-hmm. actually, I mean, your brain has to be doing that. Your brain has to be telling your heart to keep pumping. Otherwise, you wouldn't be talking to
right.
me. So we know that there are some things the brain has to be doing, some physiological things.
Yes.
But it turns out there are also a whole host of mental things the brain is doing all the time. And we're aware of maybe 5 or 10% of what our minds are doing. The vast majority of what we do, in fact, is hidden from us. And I came up with essentially what's a literary metaphor. I called it the hidden brain.
You know, what's the most puzzling things to you about human behavior? What do you still find yourself just absolutely confounded by?
The thing that I think I'm actually most drawn to in the year since I finished writing The Hidden Brain. So the Hidden Brain was basically saying, you know, there are all these things about our unconscious minds and our hidden brains that we should learn and understand. And once we learn and understand them, we won't make some of the mistakes we do. We won't be victim to some of the biases we are victim to. And we can lead much more rational, better lives. And I think what I've come to in terms of a realization since that, and that speaks to your question, is that there is actually a great gap between insight and action. That is one thing to actually know something. It's another thing to actually do something about it. And we see this all the time in our lives. You know, we need to exercise.
Yes.
We need to eat healthy. We need yes. to avoid smoking. We need to cut back on alcohol. We need to spend more time with friends and family. We need to be kinder to people. We need to be kinder to ourselves. There are a whole host of things that we know, but putting them into practice is extremely difficult. And this gap between insight and action, I'm really fascinated by.
Was there something about yourself you were just dying to learn that you maybe have gotten fuller insights into now?
You know, I joke with friends sometimes that Hidden Brain, the podcast, is really a compendium of all of my neuroses and mental errors and biases. And part of the reason we've produced...
All those stories
exactly.
all about you, yeah. Oh my gosh.
We've produced,
yeah.
you know, more than 150 episodes and have sort of story ideas for the next several years because I have a great many neuroses
yes.
and many issues.
Sure.
But I think all the time, I think one of the things that people experience when they listen to our podcast and radio show is I'm not sure people are actually listening to the radio show or the podcast. I think what they're really doing when they're listening to us is they're watching themselves. And I think that's part of the appeal of the show, that they're actually listening to the show and they're saying, I see this in myself. I see this behavior in myself. And what the show is giving you is it's giving you a bit of insight to say, it does not necessarily change what I do, but I now have a little more insight into why I'm doing
what
I'm doing.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. What made you think you could do radio? It's a big leap from print to radio.
Absolutely. I didn't think that I could do radio. And in fact, after I wrote The Hidden Brain, NPR reached out to me and asked if I would be interested in doing radio. And I said that I'd been a fan and admirer of public radio for many, many years, but I really knew nothing about radio. I still think that my knowledge of radio is fairly limited compared to many of the people who've been doing it a much longer time. But what I think I've learned is radio has incredible power and magic. I mean, and I could not agree more. There is an intimacy to the medium that is so extraordinary that it really is unrivaled. I mean, it's interesting that when you think about the big technologies, you know, you think of radio as being sort of an old technology, but in many ways, the growth of podcasting, the success of audio reflects the fact that radio journalism can do things that print and television find very difficult.
There's a connection that gets made that with listeners that I didn't find nearly as powerful when I was writing columns or story for the newspaper.
Exactly. And, you know, when you're listening to someone's voice, that person is coming into your life in a way that's really intimate. I was interviewing a researcher at Duke University named Peter Ubel once for a story, and I got him in a studio. He was in a studio at Duke, and I was here in Washington, and I said, hello, Professor Ubel, it's very nice to talk with you. And he said, you know, this is the first time I'm hearing your voice with my clothes on. And I'm like, wait, what did you just say? And it turns out that he has a shower radio, so he's hearing my voice in the shower.
I can relate to some of that, yeah.
But the thing is, when you hear people's voices in these intimate spaces, the voices you usually hear in these intimate spaces are the voices of your friends and family.
Yes.
And I think this is one of the reasons radio is so powerful. You know, when you replace a host of a show with another host, people are usually very upset. Even if they're reading the same copy, it's because you've grown attached to that voice, that person. You feel like this person is your friend.
NPR Shankar Vedantam is my guest. You hear him on the Hidden Brain podcast and Morning Edition and with Steve Inskeep and lots of other hosts as well. You know, you often do your stories as part of a dialogue of sorts with hosts like Steve Inskeep. Mm-hmm. Why do you prefer to do your stories that way?
In some ways, we stumbled into it by accident.
It's a conversation, sort of.
Yeah, I think it is. And this is actually something else that I've learned. And in some ways, I think I might actually understand this a little bit better than the people who've been doing radio a long time, because I think I understand this at a psychological level. There is something about conversations that hold our attention. Because, of course, when you think about it, and again, in evolutionary terms, our ears were designed to attend to the conversations that were happening around us. Mm-hmm. And when you see two people talking to one another, you can see this if you're sitting in a train, for example, or in a plane, and two people are having a conversation next to you. It's hard not to listen to what that conversation is, because right. That's what your ears are designed to do. And so really what we've tried to do is to say, can we build a whole genre of journalism around the idea of conversation? So in other words, you're still communicating the science, you're communicating the rigor, you're communicating things accurately, but you're doing it in a way that increases its accessibility to the people who are consuming the information.
I'm struck right now, you didn't bring any notes into the studio. Do you take notes when you do your two ways with Steve?
Usually we do have a rough outline of the conversation. And the reason we do that, it's actually helpful, in fact, not to have notes when you're really having a conversation, because you can really be present to the other person.
Yes.
The reason we have an outline is that I'm usually bringing in the voices of experts and researchers as well. So it's actually a conversation with the host, with a third party sort of coming in from time to time. And both the host and I need to know when the expert is going to come in. Otherwise, the conversation will go haywire.
And you've only got a few minutes to do it anyway.
These are very compressed chats.
The clock never goes away,
indeed,
right?
Indeed.
You've also explored how our unconscious minds elect our presidents. I mentioned already that's the title of one of your books. Now that we're back into yet another presidential race, remind our listeners, how do our unconscious minds elect our presidents?
I mean, the question really might actually be, how do they not? I mean, the number of ways in which they influence us is just mind-boggling. I mean, so just think about it at a very, very basic level. We've had 45 presidents in the United States, and every single one of them has been a man, right? Mm-hmm. The odds of this happening just by chance are zero. I mean, virtually, mathematically, they're not zero, but they're basically zero, right?
That's interesting.
Why does that happen? Why is it that men are far more likely to be seen as viable leaders than women? It goes back to how our minds associate leadership, the practice of leadership, with masculinity. Think about height.
Yeah.
Tall people tend to become president far more often than short people. Why? Our unconscious minds tend to associate height with authority. And that's just at the basic level. Think about all the ways in which policy influences us. The fact that, there have been very interesting studies where you tell Republicans and Democrats that a certain policy was basically endorsed by someone from their side. The identical policy, when a Republican hears, is a Republican policy, they're all for it. When you tell them the identical policy, but say it's a Democratic policy, they hate it, right? And so our minds, our partisanship, our tribal loyalties to our teams shape how it is we think about the news.
And yet most voters think they're so darn sophisticated. They would rise above the kinds of things you just outlined. And you say it simply isn't so.
So this is one of the most profound tricks that our minds plays on us, which is it's not just that a whole bunch of things happen unconsciously, but after they happen unconsciously, our conscious mind come up with explanations for what we did. So in other words, there's a magic trick that's happened. And after the magic trick is over, the conscious mind says, that was what I was intending to see happen all the time. I mean, that's a brilliant magic trick.
One final thing. You did a piece recently about the power that our smartphones have over us. Even when they're sitting next to us on the table during lunch, they seem to draw us toward them. What's the consequence of that?
Well, this was research by a couple of psychologists who were having lunch at a restaurant in Cambridge some years ago, and they were doing what millions of people do, which is put their phones down on the table next to them. And the phones were silent, but they realized that even when the phones were silent, the phones were calling out to them. And they actually conducted a whole series of experiments, and they found that when they ran tests on people, people did better on these mental ability tasks when they kept their phone in another room or when they kept their phones in their pockets. When you keep the phone on the table next to you, there's a small part of your mind that's drawn to the phone. And perhaps one reason we've had a very good conversation, Steve, is I remember to keep my phone in the next room before I came in to talk to you.
Very smart move. That's NPR Shankar Vedantam. What a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much, Steve.
The proprietor of the Hidden Brain podcast. You can find it anywhere. Yesterday, we learned how three Washington, D.C. museums remain relevant in an era of technology. Find that and other previous conversations. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. We're back in Kansas City next week to talk about the continued turbulence surrounding the citizen-requested audit of Clay County. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, Jamie Hobbs, and all the great folks here at NPR. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.